One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 9th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Amanda Hess. On her piece in the Pacific Standard, Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet. But before we get there, we're going to go to a live press conference with Governor Chris Christie, who is now trying to explain these recent revelations. Let's can we put up the sound a little bit?
But I spoke to them beforehand.
We're going to get to...
And Bridget Amanda clearly did not tell me the truth.
But let's listen to a little bit
Bill,
of what Christie's saying, and
you know,
we will
what he told me at the time
update you on what he's been saying at this point.
But the emails and the color and character of the emails have led me to conclude that I don't have confidence in his judgment any longer, and that's why I asked him to move on, and he has.
Now, what Christie's been doing here,
you know, at this point,
on throughout this press conference, is
rest,
he is not attacking his staffers
said
for actually doing this act of political vendetta or retribution, but the tone in which they responded to it being done,
there would be all kinds of other
he still is contending there may have been a traffic study.
I made determinations regarding their future.
Now, what's sort of shocking about this is he has already announced the firing of his deputy chief of staff, Kelly, one of the people involved in the emails and the texts going back and forth. But he did not ask her anything about it. He didn't even speak to her. He just fired her.
Who was mentioned?
Here's a guy who still doesn't know whether or not this was a real traffic study that morphed into a political vendetta, or a political vendetta that morphed into a traffic study, which sounds like a cover-up. And he's got no interest in asking his deputy chief of staff, hey,
that's your characterization, not
what
mine.
What was this?
But
let's listen in.
Nobody on my staff who had any knowledge of this issue until after the issue was already done.
Follow up on that.
I'm in the back. Yes.
Being asked a question now. He's claiming nobody on his staff had any knowledge of this issue, even
now,
though they obviously knew that their records were being subpoenaed days ago.
Whatever, but it doesn't matter. It's awful to hear.
Also, much more offended, apparently, if you believe him.
Listen, all I can do is apologize for the conduct of people who worked for me. I can't do anything else. I can't reverse time. If I could, believe me, I would. But I'm just going to apologize. I think that's all you can do. And there's really nothing else you can do. Bob David.
Governor, along the lines of doing the job as governor that you have said that you're focused on regaining the trust of the people of New Jersey, a lot of people are upset about this and shocked. The first couple of years you were governor, you did a lot of town hall meetings. You traveled all over the state and spoke to people.
So let's just recap here. He has fired his deputy chief of staff.
Oh, well, we clearly are going to
he
do town halls in second
term.
He
has his former campaign manager, who he would just announced 2 days ago was going to be head of the Republican Party in New Jersey. He has basically said jettisoned him. He is talking about how saddened he is that these people, these longtime aides, have lied to him. He said, oddly, that this has caused him two nights in a row of absolutely no sleep, but also claiming that he didn't find out about this until 8:15 a.m. yesterday morning. So he may have had one of those pre-insomniac, stress-related premonition nights of sleeplessness.
He's a visceral politician.
He felt it coming. He had a spidey sense.
The people in New Jersey are looking to see, when mistakes are made, how their leader is going to react. And I believe that when they see me take the action I'm taking today, that they'll say, mistakes were made. Governor had nothing to do with that, but he's taking responsibility for it. And he's made the decisions that need to be made and has promised us he'll continue to make those decisions. If necessary, going forward. Michael?
Two things, though. He's basically sounds more aggrieved, if you even buy his claim that he had no idea what was going on.
Listen,
that his staff didn't tell
that's
him
between David
than
and
the
his
actual
attorney.
Thing.
Definitely.
He's
way more aggrieved
by
that.
Counsel now.
And he's
I mean,
such
I'd
an egomaniac
that
the way he's conducting his press conference, he still thinks he can run for president.
He definitely still thinks he can run for president. In fact, he's touting this as what he's saying, essentially, and he said this over and over again.
I'd like to hear the story. But I don't
He's
want to be in the position of instructing
that he
someone
is
to
proven
do
right now that he has passed the test of leadership
represented by counsel.
By responding in this way,
what they
despite
is in
the
their
fact
best
that he
interest,
apparently had surrounded himself with a bunch of
you know,
pathological liars who were attacking this guy who they didn't even seek his endorsement from.
Another interesting thread here is he keeps pointing out that this mayor was, quote, not on their radar. Almost as if to say, why would we give him political retribution? He wasn't even someone we were thinking about, which is another interest. There's a lot of really interesting revealing frames here.
At his approval.
He's had barely any time on kids stuck in traffic and lack of emergency vehicle response. It's all about him, and it's all about, well, why would we politically punish him? He wasn't really on our radar.
Whether it was his idea and initiation, as Senator Barone testified, I guess time will tell. But clearly, there was knowledge of this action, whatever it was, prior to the beginning of it with Bridget Kelly. And that was something that I said in direct answer to Angie's question a few weeks ago was not the case. That's what we were told after repeated questioning of all the people around here. And I was lied to. And for that, she's been terminated.
Governor,
Angie?
Terminated without asking any questions about it. That is very odd behavior for a former prosecutor.
Well, and he framed it like, hey, I don't want to hear the excuses.
I interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of people as U.S. attorney. I did not. My AUSAs interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of people. It was the very rare occasion when the U.S. attorney himself or herself goes into a room and interviews a witness. It probably happened a dozen times in 7 years. It's a very rare occurrence. Angie, if you're trying to understand this on a personal level, if you've worked with someone for 5 years and they've been a member of your political team and then governmental team, and you look at them and you say to them, what do you know about this? And did you have any involvement? Did you have any knowledge of it? And they look at you and they say no. And you've never had any reason before to believe that they were anything but a truth teller, why wouldn't you believe them? I mean, I work on the basis of trust.
Because you didn't investigate it?
And I assume over a period of time that most people are trustworthy unless proven otherwise. And so when we asked those questions and we got those answers, there was no reason at the time we asked the questions for us to believe that they weren't true based upon the conduct of that person.
Except for the fact, of course, that there was never any traffic study.
Richard Kelly, I don't think you heard.
There were no results of the traffic study. Nobody knew of the traffic study. There was no traffic study.
Working for the legislature.
Couldn't you have said, let me see the documents that showed that you were looking to do a traffic study before?
And that's why I used the phrase before that. I was heartbroken because I trusted.
This press conference is a great example of how intimidated and in control he must be of his staff.
And I wasn't by
clearly no one
who
ever
I
says,
a significant
wrap
of
it up,
so,
dude.
Well, did I miss it?
The number one thing you are told in crisis management is stay up there until there's no more questions. And so he will be up here for a long time.
At 9, a little before 9 yesterday morning.
You're not seeing
by 9 o'clock this morning, her position was terminated.
Press. Ask him questions even internally.
And I think that's appropriate
we'll
action
see.
That people would expect from the chief executive of the state.
Governor, is this your biggest disappointment in public office?
Yeah.
The nature of Bridget's email, it sounded like they had a prearranged
I understand what you're saying. I can't read anything else into it beyond. I know you're inferring certain things from the email. I think that's a reasonable inference, but I don't know. I don't know the answer because remember, when we asked questions, we didn't even know about the existence of the email. I found that out for the first time at 8:50 yesterday morning. And you can only imagine.
After a lack of sleep the night before.
As I was standing there in my bedroom with my iPad, looking at that,
guy gets into work late.
How incredibly sad and betrayed I felt, and so I don't know what to say beyond that.
Governor
Josh,
you were a U.S. attorney in a very high-profile fashion, investigated governor, one governor, a particular governor's office, and a state.
Now, my understanding is
that people that were connected to your office.
Wildstein is going to be testifying today.
It was not as popular as Christie in high school, which is why they weren't friends.
That's right.
That's what I mean. Maybe even crisis management aside, it was time to stop the press conference.
I wasn't friends with him. The dude was
a
loser.
Come on. Hide.
Chris Christie.
And I have not given any instruction to anyone yet, but my instruction to everybody will be to cooperate and answer questions. Josh, I have nothing to hide, so any questions anybody wants to ask me, they can ask. From law enforcement, anything they want to ask, they can ask. So we have nothing to hide, and this administration has nothing to hide.
Except for the thing that just happened. We had nothing to hide except for that thing. All right, so let's just briefly recap here. Obviously, the story will continue, but we need to move on just a little bit. But just to pick up from yesterday, just to recap slightly, yesterday morning, apparently, when Chris Christie was in his PJs looking on his iPad, there was a release of subpoenaed records of David Wildstein, who was... Even though Chris Christie now, he was my child. I knew him in childhood, but I barely knew the guy before I created a six-figure job for him that had no longer previously existed for him at the Port Authority.
I felt bad by how failed he was in high school. And
he was not as popular as me, and so I said, hey, here it is. It's time for you to shine like I shined in high school. So... apparently, according to the New York Times in another version of the story later in the day, it was David Wildstein who provided to news organizations these subpoenaed records, and he is the one who had done the redacting. The biggest question coming out of those redacted files was, who was he having the text message conversation with? Who said, I sort of feel bad for the kids, I guess. And but I got a smile on my face. Who was that person? We don't know. The fact that Christie has basically jettisoned his former campaign manager suggests maybe that's the person who it was, but we don't have confirmation on that. Wildstein is testifying today. We will see what more comes out. of that testimony. I believe it could be happening very shortly, actually. And I would imagine this press conference was scheduled in such a way so that it would be tough to follow both. But there are a lot of questions that remain. There are also now multiple stories of how EMS workers were prevented from reaching people who were in need of emergency care. One woman, a 91-year-old woman, it is suspected perhaps died because they were not reached in time and brought to the hospital in time because of delays, because of the traffic that doubled their response time. This is not going to go away, but Chris Christie clearly believes that he's still in the sweeps for 2016. And frankly, that's the only way. You've only got two choices here. One is you bow your head and you say, I'm leaving for good, or you just keep swinging for the fences. And so this is yet to end. There's been an announced investigation by the U.S. Attorney in New Jersey, someone who was basically handpicked by Chris Christie anyways. So I would imagine that it's possible that may not be as rigorous of as an investigation as we might see. These people have a lot of discretion, but there's still very likely going to be some type of federal hearings. Certainly they had been called for before, and the hearings in the Senate are ongoing, and people are going to start being put under oath, which should perhaps maybe change their testimony this time around. But I think Chris Christie is deluding himself that 2016 is still a possibility for him.
He's clearly an egomaniac, but I just think it's so clear that you listen to this press conference and you look at his response, and he's coming up. It's almost like a new political tactic of aggressive and verbose incompetence, because what he's basically saying is, I had no idea what was going on. All these key people were lying to me. They used state resources to do this horrible thing. I had no clue it was happening because people were lying to me, and I have no idea what was happening. And that's it. And I'm firing them now, which is exactly why I'm the leader America needs. I haven't quite seen something put together quite in that same way before.
That's right.
It's like I have absolutely no idea what I'm doing or my staff is doing, and that's leadership.
We got to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking to Amanda Hess on her piece in the Pacific Standard about why women are excessively, not, I don't know if even excessively, but basically getting all sorts of abuse online. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Amanda Hess, freelance writer from Los Angeles, whose piece in the Pacific Standard, Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet. Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I mean, I think that many people, certainly I've had an awareness of the particular abuse that women get online. I mean, I think, you know, most people who write online or are figures online get some type of abuse. But I think, you know, your piece really is enlightening in terms of just how dramatic this is for women as opposed to men and the implications of it. Let's start just, I mean, with your own story on what you've been subjected to.
So I've been receiving threatening and abusive comments basically since I started writing on the internet in 2007. But most recently, the incident that I talk about in the piece was this past summer I was on vacation in Palm Springs when, you know, I woke up at 5:30 in the morning because a friend of mine had texted me telling me I should check out a Twitter account that had basically been set up for the purposes of threatening me. So I woke up in the morning on my vacation and was met with a series of tweets from someone saying that they lived in my state, that they were going to come to my house and rape me and cut off my head, which was obviously distressing. But from there, I sort of went through the process of, you know, reporting that threat to the police and seeing just how ill-equipped law enforcement is to deal with crimes that happen over the internet.
I mean, let's talk about it because, you know, I mean, I think to a certain extent, the reaction that the initial reaction that some people anyways have to stories like this is like, you know, the internet is just it's a mean place or can be a mean place. We've all, you know, in some way been subjected to this, you know, and my own personal experience is that, frankly, to the extent that I was subjected to this, it was far worse when I was working with a woman, simply because of I could A, see the abuse that she was taking, and that because of my close proximity, somehow some of that rubbed off on me. But just give us an example. I mean, also, I mean, talk about how this is not simply an isolated event, and we'll go into the law enforcement aspect of it, but not a simply an isolated experience that you've had, but this is a genuine phenomena that women who are essentially in the internet business or the writing business, this is a common, I mean, an incredibly common occurrence.
It's true, and it's something that I've, you know, been very aware of, not just because I've sort of received that sort of commentary myself, but because I think, you know, women tend to talk about this among themselves. We ask for advice and we sort of share our stories in an attempt to find some sort of positive community around them. And unfortunately, there's not a huge body of research on, you know, exactly what the demographics are of this problem, but there is some indication that from an early age, girls are cyberbullied more than boys are, that women are more likely to receive threatening comments and for them to materialize into a potential physical threat that happens offline. And I'm hoping that as this issue gets more recognition, that there'll be, you know, even more research into exactly how often it happens.
Talk a little bit about the notion that, well, it's, you know, it's not the real world. It's just the cyber world, and it really doesn't have any real world implications. You expand on that notion in your piece. Tell us about it.
Well, I think first of all, the idea that abuse of women is not a real problem. It's something that women have been dealing with for a long time, you know, far before we were on the internet. So domestic violence, sexual harassment against women in the workplace, before they were seen as serious discrimination issues and civil rights issues, they were sort of laughed off as, you know, harmless flirting or just sort of the the natural product of men and women being in relationships with each other. And I think we're seeing a similar phenomenon happening now that that abuse has moved to the internet. But for people who say that, you know, the internet is a mean place, it's a bad place, and everyone just has to deal with it, I think that means that we're setting, as a society, a really low bar for ourselves. We're all spending increasing amounts of time on the internet. It's increasingly central to our lives. And I think we all, you know, deserve for that community to be as moral and safe as any other community that we live in.
Yeah, and it's not just, it's not just a question of, a kumbaya moment. This is also a question of, this has implications for you as a writer, or for, I mean, you talk about, you go into some detail about Jessica Valenti's experience, and when you repeatedly get these type of violent responses and stalkers, it begins to implicate your ability to actually do your job. I mean, these are jobs for people, and this becomes a massive liability for a woman trying to work or share material on the internet versus a man.
Right. I think a lot of times when a woman receives a rape threat, for example, a common response is, well, you know, it's very unlikely that you're actually going to be physically raped, and so you should just ignore it. But there are many ways that this abuse cumulatively has very real effects on women. Jessica Valenti, who I spoke with, has spent a lot of money, a lot of time, in order to, protect herself on the internet, to scrub the internet of her personal information, to make sure she has enough security when she speaks in public, to refrain from publicizing her events in advance in an attempt to sort of hope that they will be safer. And a lot of women, you know, just leave. They stop working on the internet, which I think a lot of us, you know, are starting to realize that that's not a tenable solution. It's something, you know, it's a requirement of many of our jobs to be there.
Yeah, I mean, and this is in Valenti's experience is just sort of one end of the spectrum. I mean, I imagine it implicates when you sit down to write something. I've got to imagine this is on your mind in a way that it probably isn't for most men who write. I mean, you know, it doesn't sound terribly comforting to me that like it's very unlikely that anybody's going to do anything to follow up on these threats doesn't seem to be terribly comforting.
Right. I think there's this tendency for some people to say that women are oversensitive. But really, you know, what we're talking about is just sort of an emotional capability to do our jobs. And for everyone, male or female, you know, the fewer sort of ridiculous, ancillary, threatening experiences they have to deal with in the course of their jobs, the more successful they're going to be. So that's why, you know, some legal scholars who I spoke to are starting to see this as an extension of discrimination against women in the workplace and are working to sort of codify that into law.
I want to get back to and talk about that, but tell us the story of Caroline Criado Perez.
So Caroline is a writer in the UK who last summer suggested that the Bank of England put more money on its currency. So at the time, it had just been, you know, male historical figures who were being printed on money. Seems like a fairly inoffensive campaign that she started, and she received a volume of threats that she wasn't even capable of reading. They were sort of coming in so fast, so hundreds a day of people, you know, telling her things from just sort of basic, vile, misogynistic comments to specific threats of death and rape. And what she found when she went to the police was that, you know, they basically said, this is such a huge problem. You're receiving so many threats that we can't really deal with them. We don't have the capability of doing it, and it's something that Twitter should take responsibility for themselves.
And so what is happening on that front? I mean, what is happening and what could be done in this instance?
So actually a good bit of news is that yesterday, I believe it was two men who had threatened her under their real names, so it was pretty easy to identify who they were, pled guilty to some charges in that case. And I'm not as familiar with the laws in the UK, but in the US, there are already laws in the books that could conceivably be applied to threats that are made online. For example, in California, you know, it's a crime to threaten bodily harm to another person, and it's not specified, you know, in what medium that threat is made. But what I found is, it's funny because for a long time, you know, if someone threatened you, a sort of typical dismissal from the police would be that it was a he said, she said case, and that it was difficult to prove, you know, what the person actually said. But now on the internet, we have so much documentation, but there's now this sort of an additional excuse that either it's not as real because it's on the internet, it's not as credible a threat, or just that, you know, the police are so uninterested in investigating it that it's impossible for the victim to even find out where the threat is coming from, because often it's coming from anonymous accounts.
And so, I mean, and that was your experience with the police, right? I mean, the guy shows up and says, the officer you called shows up and says, what's Twitter? And so, I mean, here's the dilemma, right? I mean, is that we have a, what could, let's say, Twitter do more? Or, I mean, where, and assuming that we go further with sort of this theory of this being a form of discrimination against women, how do we address this? I mean, is it something that has to happen from a law enforcement perspective? Is it something that has to happen from a technology perspective? Or ultimately, is this, you know, just sort of an extension of a cultural problem we have?
Well, one of the more interesting things I think that came out of my research is that it's not an easy problem to solve. So in the wake of Caroline's very public and publicized experiences, there were a lot of people who were sort of calling on Twitter to implement a report abuse button, which they did. But what I found is that a button is not something that's going to solve this extremely wide-ranging problem. And it's difficult because while I personally think it's a criminal matter, police departments, especially, you know, me calling the Palm Springs Police Department, which is very small, they don't have the resources or, in my case, even the education to really investigate all of these issues. And then you have someone like Twitter or a company like Twitter, which has all the money in the world but does not sort of have the legal authority or the interest to chase down criminals. And so that's one reason I think why some legal scholars are looking to see it as a civil matter that could sort of be mediated in this alternate space that sort of sees it as discrimination and might give women some opportunities to seek civil recourse.
And in the case of something like Twitter, it is this problem sort of bumps up against a sort of some privacy issues. I mean, you talk about how the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which certainly is an organization I have very good, associations of. I associate with very positive advocacy. Is also has sort of like privacy concerns, right? I mean, so that's where this becomes sort of at loggerheads, right? How do you not give cover to people who are engaging in this type of abusive and threatening behavior, but simultaneously also how do you protect the privacy of individuals who are using Twitter?
Right. It's an extremely complicated question. I mean, obviously, for women on the Internet, you know, even in the course of this piece, it's obvious that privacy is very important to us also. And so, you know, it would be we were not looking for a solution that would sort of put us in a position where our information or our opinions are being sort of compromised because privacy is compromised. One thing I would say is, you know, a limitation of me as a journalist is that I'm not a programmer. But what we have is sort of some of the brightest minds in our country going to work in Silicon Valley now. And my hope is when this issue is really taken seriously by tech companies, that there'll be an opportunity for innovation in this space. And unfortunately, you know, I don't have any silver bullets right now, but I'm hopeful that it's something that will be addressed because I think it just simply has to be.
And I mean, what do you think it's going to take? I mean, for this the level of awareness to rise to where these things are being taken seriously, it either as potential sort of bodily threats or being taken seriously as something that is fundamentally inhibiting women's use and access in some ways to the Internet?
Well, I think one solution is to get more women in law enforcement and into technology companies, both of which are extraordinarily male-dominated. But I also think that there are a lot of men who are very sympathetic to this issue. I actually just saw some police officers in Mountain View, California, which is a pretty small jurisdiction, recently joined Twitter, I think yesterday. The chief of police joined Twitter, and some of their followers sent them the story, and they had a productive discussion about it. So I think, you know, the more these technology companies can sort of work in accordance with law enforcement, even if it's on this very sort of casual basis, I think that's an important piece too.
Do you have a sense, I mean, you know, on some level this is sort of seems maybe somewhat self-evident. I mean, obviously this type of abuse exists offline, and obviously when you're online as a perpetrator of this type of abuse, you have a certain anonymity. You have a certain you're somehow sort of you can. It's easier maybe to compartmentalize this. Talk about what in the course of your researching for this piece, what you gathered is sort of the psychological issues that are behind this, and why does this happen so much? I mean, you know, and I guess I'm sort of also more conscious of it, like on YouTube. Do you have a sense of who these abusers are? Is there a profile of these people? Why does it proliferate so much?
It's a great question. I sort of liken to abuse on the Internet to street harassment, which, you know, if you ask any woman, is extremely prevalent. It will probably happen to most women walking down the street, you know, in any given day. And you point to one of the sort of greatest issues here, which is that the people who are, you know, making comments against women, whether it's on the street or on the Internet, are sort of able to not see it as a core part of their identity. Online specifically, they can hide under an anonymous account and lodge hateful things at women and then go about their day, you know, go to work, watch TV or whatever. But the comments that they're making are being made to women who are often, you know, existing on the Internet under their full names. It impacts their reputation. And also, you know, if we do what some police officers have told us, which is just to get off Twitter or to close our laptops, then we're going to walk outside and probably be harassed on the street. So I think women are well aware of the fact that, you know, a technological fix, like a button, is not something that's going to address this core issue, which is that some men, you know, still don't think it's the place of women to talk on the internet or elsewhere.
I mean, you know, and of course, the suggestion that all you need to do is close your laptop or close your Twitter account is frankly, you know, getting to the point where it's as if they're saying, you know, just stop using your telephone and everything will be fine. You know, it's become that important part of our lives. Do you have a sense, and, you know, I don't know if anybody's in a position to answer this question, but is the profile, are these the same people? I mean, the people who are street harassers, is it your sense that these are the same people as who will engage in this type of harassment and vitriol? And it's not just vitriol. I mean, this is I think qualitatively something different, but harassment online. In other words, like, you know, is the person who's doing this on the street, are they then going online to do this? Or does, like, doing it online fulfill some desire that they can't fulfill, you know, on the streets?
I mean, I think the internet has certainly opened the opportunity for more people to do it. You know, if you happen to be a shy misogynist, for example, you can simply threaten women online instead of, you know, having to do it in person, which I think has, you know, sort of been one reason why it's so prevalent online. Another thing that I would say is, you know, all of this abuse that happens to women in person is really difficult to sort of identify and to document. But on the internet, you know, these threats live forever in some cases. And so one of the sort of positive things about it is that it's easier for a woman to point to a tweet and say, you know, to her male colleagues or to her friends, this is the stuff that I'm dealing with. Whereas if she's walking down the street by herself and someone says something to her, you know, it may not be as easy to communicate that to the rest of her community.
Were you nervous about writing this piece? I mean, I think it, you know, because from my perspective, obviously, it's both very courageous in terms of just sort of, you know, broadly speaking, telling the story, but also just from a very sort of a micro level, I would imagine writing a piece like this is you must have some, it must, the act of writing this piece must sort of mirror the dynamic that you're writing about.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I've seen among some women I've talked to, is that the act of speaking out against this abuse tends to attract more abuse. So far that hasn't been the case for me, and actually I've been really overwhelmed with the positive responses to the article. But the thing that I was most nervous about is that women have sort of been writing about specific instances of this happening for many years in a lot of different spaces. And the thing that I was most nervous about is whether I could successfully, you know, advance the conversation beyond just sort of an individual instance, which I think is very easy for people to dismiss, and to present it in a way that showed that it's actually a society-wide problem, and that there are large institutions like technology companies and law enforcement officials who are either not helping the problem or are contributing to it.
I mean, I think one of the things that makes it, you know, sort of the argument more compelling now is simply that technology, even relative to where it was 5, maybe 10 years, well, certainly 10 years ago, it's just not the same. I mean, that the you are genuinely the segment of society that's engaging in this type of harassment is genuinely closing down an avenue for women that is becoming increasingly impossible to, you know, not populate that avenue. In other words, it's you, for women, this becomes both an economic and a civil rights issue.
Right. And, you know, another interesting development in the past 10 or 5 years is that women also have a lot of spaces now to talk about this and to find support for abuse. And so the internet has been really wonderful in a lot of ways in allowing us the opportunity to do that. It's just sort of this tug of war between the positive aspects of it and the negative ones. And if we decide to close our laptops, then we lose all the positives along with the negatives, too.
Well, Amanda Hess, I really appreciate you coming on and talking about this. And again, I think it was, knowing at least from a political dynamic and having spoken in the past to people who, you know, even 10 years ago were talking about the how reporters can get intimidated, particularly in sort of the political sphere. If they write something, they would get harassing, sort of more, I think in some ways benign, but a wave of harassment from the right that would temper how they write. They write online or write in the press. I think in some ways this problem has become exponentially larger, both in quantity and in the quality of the intimidation that it could lead to. And so I just wanted to, you know, congratulate you on it. I think it takes a lot of courage.
Thank you so much.
And I appreciate you coming on today. Amanda Hess, we will link to the piece at majority.fm. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll see if Chris Christie is still taking questions. Is he taking questions still? Is he still going?
I think so.
We will come back with that and see what's happening. Wow. Is there really fast track is happening right now?
It's looking like that. Listeners been tweeting us, and I'm just seeing some other stuff that it might be introduced on a Senate committee today.
In a Senate committee, but there's not going to be a vote on.
Yeah, I don't think that. I think there's going to be a vote on the committee. I don't think it's going to be up like a up or down full Senate or full House vote. And I'm also wondering. I think fast track, as far as I understand the political calculus of it, it might be harder to pass the House potentially.
Fast track is going to be much harder to pass the House than the Senate, and the Senate I think would pass it in a moment.
Right.
The House is going to be the big struggle, but right. just to make sure that everybody's on the same page, fast track is an authority that the Senate and the House grants to the president to. Essentially, offer a negotiated deal, trade deal, and in the Senate there can be no filibusters or amendments, and in the House there can be no amendments added. So it's an up or down vote, which makes it a lot harder to stop that bill. And we've talked. Quite a bit on this program about the TPP and the Trans-Pacific Partnership and its sort of cousin. There's a deal also with the EU, which I imagine that fast track authority would be for both of them. They both basically cede sovereignty of democratically elected governments in their ability to create a statutory regime, regulations for labor, environment, for consumer protections that are essentially reduced down to the lowest common denominator and then adjudicated by a 3-person corporate industry lawyer panel to determine whether or not the regulations that are imposed on corporations in any one given nation that is a part of this deal somehow inhibits the profit projections of that company when entering into that market. And therefore, that, in quotes, offending country must make up the difference pay essentially a fine for imposing any type of regulations that they see fit to protect their workers, consumers, environment, what have you, that they essentially have to pay a fine to that company for doing so. We've seen some examples of this via NAFTA with companies coming from Canada here and companies from here going to Canada where regulations don't allow them to exploit the marketplace in the way that they had projected they could. And so this is, in a general sense, that's the problem with these trade bills. When you get into there's also other aspects about so-called intellectual property, which are also very problematic, sort of embedded versions of what we know as a sort of like SOPA, also impacts pharmaceuticals. There are countries which have less protection in terms of protecting non-generic pharmaceuticals from being able to be exploited for an extended period of time. And this aims squarely at that as well. So this is very problematic, in addition to its the problems with labor and environmental regulations. So this is something that if you have the opportunity to contact your senator, and for that matter, your House representative, and tell them no to TPP, do so. We'll put a link. I think that this gives you the phone number.
Fight for the Future has a website, stopfasttrack.com.
Yeah, we'll put a link to that at majority.fm. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, there's been very little written about this, this fast track moving forward in recent days. So I'm a little bit surprised to see that. But let's take a break. When we come back, we will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. We'll take your IMs at Majority FM. You can IM us via the app. Go to majorityapp.com.
We got a tweet from a listener. There was a discussion yesterday at a rally in Albany on implications TPP would have on fracking bans. And it's bad news all around.
Right. I don't doubt it. I mean, because you're seeding not just local authority in terms of like municipalities and states, but you're ceding local authority when it comes to your country.
Well, in some ways, the irony of these trade bills is that they're not trade bills per se. They're actually regulatory bills.
That's right.
And they're deregulatory bills.
That's right.
That's what it's about.
Right. What we're seeing is less about sort of trying to shore up America's trade parity and more about ceding sovereign nation authority to a one world government that actually consists of a three-person corporate panel.
So race to the bottom. That's the other phrase. That's all. Yeah. And also financial regulations are implicated by this, too.
That's right.
Big
Although,
third.
I think, you know.
Lou did say that he made some caveats, but nonetheless, do we really want the global financial architecture to be connected like that and potentially deregulated and further kind of
right.
Cut
well,
down
once you
the
set
future.
The once you set the sort of the structure for these type of deals, then
the trajectory is downward.
Implicate implicating them in other sectors, it becomes much easier. Folks, you can become a member of this program and support this program's free show every day, which we provide for you. Even though some days we contemplate not giving you a free show, but we're just between the three of us. Like I say, like we shouldn't do this today. And then somebody says we should do.
Well, we gave a great, the show yesterday was such a great advertisement for why you should become a member. That's what we came down on.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if that pays off. And then, if it doesn't, you guys will be docked. but you can become a member today at majority.fm. Please, we need your support to be able to do this show on a daily basis and hopefully to grow it and to do it in the years and months to come. And as a bonus, you get the second half. So you basically, you can look at it as I'm paying for the show that I like to listen to every day, or I'm getting more of the show that I like to listen to every day, or I'm actually paying so that I have the choice between two different shows every day. Maybe we should cut it up into four segments. So you have four choices. So become a member today at majority.fm. Again, we don't turn anybody away who wants access to the funner half, regardless of means. I think all we ask of those people, and we ask it of everybody, is just tell your friends. Particularly with the app now, you can have the show on demand or live so easily. And it's the app is free, so certainly pass that around at majorityapp.com. You can also support this show by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. We created the URL because we get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. That's JustCoffee.coop. It's a co-op. It's owned by its workers, and they provide fair trade payments for their products. And it's also great coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes. Give us a review on the app. DonateYourAccount.com/MAJORITYFM. What else can you do to help us?
You could, I think you said it all. What, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, you said it all. Donate your account, you said it.
Okay.
You did it. Did the Amazon link, which is MajorityReportKickback.com. .com, yes.
All right, so we'll see you in the better half.